Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. And oh my God, you guys, you know that I love a luxurious set of sheets. And I now have such a set of sheets because of a Miracle Made. They are bedding that has been inspired by NASA. They've got silver-infused fabrics that actually make temperature regulating a thing. So you're not like getting too hot or too cold or whatever, you know, the whole thing that happens with your body's temperature losing its mind. Miracle Made helps with that. One of the little things that my husband particularly loves about Miracle Made is that it like doesn't have as much bacteria as regular sheets because of it's infused with this silver that prevents up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. So it leaves the sheets cleaner for longer. And then the thing for my husband is that it doesn't give him acne, which is like an issue for some people. But more than all of that, it's just luxuriously comfortable and delightful. And it has that cooling feeling while also being cozy. Very hard to achieve those two things at the same time. I mean, Miracle Made, come on, well done. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and buy some sheets today. And if you order today, you can save 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION at the checkout and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. So there's just a lot of savings here, folks. Order today, you'll get 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION. And Miracle's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, which I don't see happening, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. I want to tell you about a brand new podcast on Earwolf. It's called Best Friends with Nicole Byer and Sasheer Zamata. You probably know Nicole from her podcast appearances or from Nailed It on Netflix. And of course, you know Sasheer from Saturday Night Live. Also, she's a friend, and she's so funny and she's so great. Best Friends is a podcast about best friendship. Simple as that. Nicole and Sasheer chat with each other and other best friends and answer friendship questions from listeners. My best friend is Anka in Los Angeles. I've actually promoted her restaurants here on Fake the Nation, which I'll do again, Lemon Poppy Kitchen and Parsnip. They're so delicious. And if we had a podcast, we'd probably be talking about, I don't know, back episodes of Northern Exposure. You guys remember that show from the 90s and early aughties, I think? Anyways, and if you don't have one, like, you'll have this podcast. Also, there's still time for you. You can just work on it. So find Best Friends in your podcast app now and subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 152.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we go show the baby to the parents in California. I am not actually in New York City, you guys, right now as you hear this. I'm visiting my parents. And I am your host, Nagin Farsad. Did I say my name at all? Unclear. Anyways, I am your host, Nagin Farsad. And if I didn't already say that, and I am with my daughter, and I'm in Palm Springs, California. We're sort of like a Melissa and Joan Rivers style mother-daughter team, only instead of asking, who are you wearing? We're asking, where are you pooping? That's what we're doing. And we're going to kick things off by taking some of my favorite conversations out of the Fake the Nation vault for the auditory consumption of you, our dearest listeners. That's right. You're about to enjoy these previously recorded but never released conversations with the likes of Paul F. Tompkins, Rhea Butcher, Sarah Pappalardo, John Lovett, Dan Taberski, and Aaron Jackson. And oh my God, I can't believe this lineup of individuals. So let us begin with topic number one. So for this segment, we read a piece in The Atlantic called The People Who Eat the Same Meal Every Day, and I strangely felt compelled to talk about it. And joining me to talk about these mono-cuisined oddballs are two of my favorite comedians, you guys. It's Rhea Butcher and Paul F. Tompkins. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay. So this is a really dumb topic. I recognize that. But what do you guys think of people who eat the same thing every day? And are you secretly one of those people?
I feel like I get it.
I totally get it.
I don't know how long I could do it, but I could eat the same thing every day. I bet for a while.
When I had an office job, I did pretty much eat the same thing every day. Because
what was it?
What was the food?
Yeah.
Every morning I would, well, when I was riding my bike, it was much different than when I stopped riding my bike, but I would have an egg and like a vegetarian sausage patty. I would get on my bike. I would go to work. I used to eat bike food. Yeah, bike food. Sourdough crackers with cream cheese on them and then like vegetarian bacon.
Wait,
like
I was eating sourdough crackers
with cream cheese on them. And then, yeah, you know, protein, fat, very limited diet. The person I was seeing at the time just found out they had diabetes 1, so I was eating a very diabetic diet.
Aww.
Yeah.
That's really kind.
And then after that, I was eating a Starbucks sandwich every morning. We had broken up. And I had like a Starbucks sandwich because there was a Starbucks in the basement. I got the same sandwich every day. Mm-hmm. It was like this egg and cheese thing. It was really good, actually. Yeah. Thanks, Howard Schultz, 2020. Just kidding. I'm not. No. I'm just, that's sarcastic. This is a comedy show. Please don't take me seriously.
When I was in high school, my mother made me the same. I liked this certain lunch meat. She made me these sandwiches and made a bunch of them and then froze them so that I could take it out of the freezer. Yeah, meal prep. And I would take it to school and I could have the sandwich. Now,
wait, so it would thaw by the time it was lunchtime?
That
or
was the idea. Okay. And for the most part, it did. It would be, though, soggy.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that sounds so sad.
And dry. There would be no condiments on it.
Oh, boy.
And for some reason, I didn't know. I don't know if, like, we didn't have a condiments. Like, I don't think we had condiments at school. I don't know. But I would eat this fucking dry sandwich.
This is horrible.
I did that for a while, and I finally said, yeah, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
I waited until they ran out, and then I
How many sandwiches did she make?
Oh, man. This was like maybe a month of dry sandwiches.
30 sandwiches.
Yeah, 5 days.
But that's funny that it took you a month to say something.
I didn't feel that it was my place to say anything, which is odd because I was not above complaining.
Did you feel condemned, Paul?
I felt condemned. I was condemned to the sandwiches.
Frozen dry sandwiches. I think something about this article that struck me is most of the people in this article do very like repetitive and specific jobs too. And I feel like when you repeat the same thing every day, it takes away choice. And sometimes freedom of choice is often debilitating.
Absolutely.
A prison.
And you spend so much time in it. And then also one of the people in this article said it was helping her with her recovery from eating disorder, that like she's mindful eating. Mm-hmm. And so her eating the same thing every day allows her to have freedom from the thing she's eating, which I found very fascinating. And like, I think I like food. I think it's very cool. I like watching people cook, all that stuff. But when you're just in a job that you go to every day, like, sometimes you just want the whole day to kind of just go smoothly, you know, and just having the same thing every day. Mm-hmm. You can count on it. It's there. You know you like it. You're going to keep eating it. Here we go.
Let me say, I'm also on the record saying food is cool. but also, whenever I've worked in an office, I hated lunchtime having to make that choice.
Oh, yeah.
And especially if it's like the five places that are around you, you know, and here's the menu book and all that. I was absolutely always happy when I caved and said, I'm just going to bring the same thing to work every day. I'm totally fine with that. I liked not having to think about it.
I, yeah, I mean, the idea of like whenever – you know, there's a group text because you guys, I have friends. And whenever there's a group text that's like, where are we going to meet for dinner or brunch or whatever? It's, I want to kill myself because the tyranny of choice there is so exacting. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I feel like I'm the person in my group of friends that makes the choice most often. Like, I take the lead, or like, I'm not ashamed to step in there and suggest a restaurant. And, but it also come, I mean, you know, with that kind of leadership comes some failures, you know, where we've walked into a place and people are like, this place sucks. You know what I mean? And I'm like, fuck. And so I think that I'm often like, well, we shouldn't just go to the same fucking place. But I think there is also something nice about, you know, being a regular. Like,
I love it. It's my favorite thing on the planet. Because I was also going to say that Starbucks sandwich, like, I literally became friends with the people that worked in the Starbucks because I like talking to people. Like, I like having a regular place to go and being like, what's up? And I don't care that somebody thinks I'm boring. Like, I am boring. Yeah. Sometimes it's really fun to be boring, to just be boring.
It's hip to be square.
Huey Lewis and the news.
No, but there's something, I mean, you release endorphins when you're like, hey, Susan, Fred, how's it going? Yeah. The kids, you know what I mean? There's definitely, you definitely get that. And you get that when you do the same fucking thing all the time.
And also, I would say dietary restrictions is a big part of it too, because I typically like go into a place and I'm like, do you have plain cheese pizza? Like, cause that's, I know I can eat that. Cause I've been a vegetarian my whole life. And when I was a kid, I would go places and not be able to eat anything. And so being able to eat the same thing predictably is like, it just relieves a lot of pressure on my mind.
Now, you'll ask this at any restaurant, right?
Literally any restaurant,
do you have plain cheese pizza?
Yeah, it's like that TV movie about Benihana. The trucker that couldn't drive.
Yeah, welcome to BF Chang's.
Do you have plain cheese pizza? The trucker that couldn't drive. Sometimes you try to make a reference and you say the wrong thing, but it's funnier. The trucker who couldn't drive.
Oh what shit. A TV movie.
It was a real struggle for him to be a trucker who couldn't drive.
He just people.
Sat in the front seat.
He had one of those video screens that went by that made it look like he was driving.
He was a functional non-driver.
Carpool lane.
But you know what's interesting? One of the things I found interesting about the article was that this food study scholar at NYU said that newness or difference from the norm is a very urban, almost postmodern quest. It is recent. It is class-based. Because, like, this conversation is ridiculous. Like, if we were in, the rice fields of Vietnam, like, in 1947 or whatever, you know? We're not.
So that's why we're having the conversation.
I like to judge all of my conversations based on whether or not they fly.
Do we have a time machine? I would love if we had a time machine and we went to the rice fields in Vietnam in 1949 and was like, do you bring the same thing to lunch every day? How do you feel about it?
Like, tell me what your cubicles are like. No, it's so, and in the history of time, the idea of having choice, because like, it's like in those old movies, right? People would just like walk in those old movies that are talking about the Middle Ages or whatever, which we, and I'm probably even just referencing Game of Thrones and I don't even know it or something.
I thought you were
like,
talking about Sword in the Stone.
Which I don't know what that is anyway. I'm not, is that...
It's a Disney movie.
Oh, got you. So like in those, all of those movies, whether they're fantasy or about the Middle Ages, a person walks into a place and is like, I'll take some food, you know? And it's like this general, you know, it's not like, oh, why don't you refer to the menu and today our special is, you know, it's like, I'll just have food. And then they throw at you like whatever it is they have. So that I think has been most of the history of time. And also I'm acting like everyone was going to restaurants in the Middle Ages. That also was not, I think, a thing.
Travelers had to go to an inn.
Right.
You know?
Those travelers had to go to a place. Yeah, a place.
Be like, how many in your party? Four? Here's a buzzer. But it was a buzzard waiting on your shoulder.
And it was a raven.
It's a living.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea of like even having choice. So I guess what I'm saying here is human evolution suggests that we have wanted, we have not had choice. We've not even adapted to having choice. So the idea that some people, by the way, and the statistics are 17% of British people in a survey had eaten the same lunch every day for 2 years. Another survey said that a third of Brits ate the same lunch every day. I don't know why the British are so interested in this particular form of questioning on their surveys. But I think the basic human condition suggests that we want to eat the same thing every day because we've just been doing it since the beginning of time. And mm-hmm. only, you know, only since Howard Schultz introduced multiple sandwiches at Starbucks.
The great billionaire. Oh, I'm sorry.
Have we
person
had
of means.
As much choice.
Person, yeah.
person of means, person of means. Wealth.
May he lead us into a new era.
Scalding hot death.
Which, by the way, for a place that has so many options of coffee, I have disliked almost all of the options. Yeah. I have a gift card in my purse, you guys. As it was like a Christmas gift card situation mm-hmm. that I've been at pains to utilize mm-hmm. because it just... I don't, by choice walk into mm-hmm. Starbucks.
You know what you should do, Nagin? You should give it to someone who's like asking for food.
There
oh, yeah. No, that's a great idea.
And because
actually.
they could buy food, they could buy whatever they want with it, obviously. You're not going to tell them yeah. what to buy. Then they would also have access to the bathroom.
Oh, true. You know what? I'm today's show is sponsored by Prose. This is kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm on some sort of Lord of the Rings journey. Trying to figure out skincare. And I feel like this customized skincare line is really got my name on it. Basically, every bottle of Prose custom hair care and skincare, I tried the skincare just recently, is made to order and it's personalized. It's got a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs, like specifically you. And then the way they do it is you take this great, like in-depth quiz, basically. They analyze over 80 factors for a complete view of your life, your beauty goals. Like I have oily skin that's also dry, which is just a fun little conundrum. I live in New York City. Like we've got these four seasons. My face gets weird during seasonal shifts. I all of these things I got to kind of talk about in answering the questions. The other fun thing was they asked us at the end, like, do you like a creamy type of moisturizer or like a less creamy kind? And I was kind of like, I think like less creamy. And they were like, that's fine. Like you can do that. But we think for your skin type, creamier is better. And I never knew that. So I love that there's so much kind of personal information that goes into creating this. I got my stuff in the mail very quickly after. I got a wonderful serum. Like I said, this very creamy moisturizer. And this also very just delectably creamy cleanser that just kind of feel like I think it's possible that I've been washing my face with just like harshness. For like many years, because when I saw this cleanser, I was like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like? It's supposed to feel like a little bit of a delight on my face. That's not what I've been doing. So I don't know, guys. And here's the thing. You don't have to take my word for it. In a third party, double blind dermatologist supervised controlled clinical study, which is like the gold standard for research studies, Prose prove that personalization works better than off-the-shelf alternatives, which just sort of totally makes sense on a just logical level if you think about it. Just it makes common sense. Prose is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% of your first subscription order at prose.com/fakethenation will be taken off. That's prose.com/fakethenation. You get your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formulas. Again, that's prose.com/fakethenation. Go and get your just super personalized, luxurious skincare products and hair care products. That's what I'm going to try next. So prose.com/fakethenation. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app. And I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money. And because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry. Thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you. So you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm embarrassed that I haven't already just done that.
No, don't be embarrassed. You didn't think about it. You're stressed about Starbucks. No, I'm not. I'm not at all.
We all know
it now. I just had a thought and I shared it. That's it. But now, not any better than you.
Is your
look,
name?
Look, I'll be accepting rage tweets about this.
You should have thought about that.
The floor is open for rage tweets. is your name's not associated with a gift card, right? It's just got a dollar amount on it, and that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
unless
yeah.
you like whoever, register it or right. whatever. But that's only for if you lose cool. it.
Right.
I mean, I think only maniacs would register a gift card. Like, who spends yeah, the time?
Absolutely. Maniacs.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for
you're
sure.
just like a horrible person would do that. I will also be accepting rage tweets on that statement. So please make sure you reference this particular part of the segment. All right. Now we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got funny liberals talking about why liberals are funny. Everyone has a family member who always tells the best stories. Storyworth makes it easy and fun for your loved ones to share their stories with weekly emailed story prompts or questions you've never thought to ask. At the end of the year, you'll get these stories bound in a beautiful hardcover book. Storyworth is a great way to stay in touch and bridge geographic distance by providing lively discussion topics for the whole family. Learn about your relatives with questions that elicit entertaining, surprising, and sometimes moving responses. Then pass on treasures to your children and their future families with a beautiful keepsake book. Write stories and upload photos by email on the web or in the app and invite an unlimited number of people to receive them. Everything is private and secure. Your control who sees your stories. It's also a great gift for Mother's Day or Father's Day upcoming, y'all. So strengthen your family bonds and get to know your loved ones in a whole new way with Storyworth. Guys, these books are really beautiful. Like, I feel like we've come to a time where like gift giving is... I mean, you could buy a shirt for your dad and he'll be happy about it or whatever. Or like you could get something like this that's super meaningful and he'll keep forever and like look at and in times of woe and feel mushy feelings. And I feel like that's kind of what people want now, like out of a real gift. You know what I'm saying? So for $20 off, visit storyworth.com/fake when you subscribe. Again, that's storyworth.com/fake. You'll get $20 off. It's just a really great idea, a really great gift. The Citizenry is a socially conscious home decor brand that partners with master artisans across the globe to bring time-tested craftsmanship to the modern home. The Citizenry creates exclusive collections sold direct to you online without the middleman markup, with pieces crafted in over 15 countries. Their collections are designed to highlight the unique materials and craft traditions of each destination. Their iconic lumbar pillow comes in bold designs, reimagined and inspired by the geometric patterns used by the Zapotec tribes of the Oaxaca region in Mexico. Each pillow is hand-dyed and takes a talented weaving cooperative 3 days to make, all made start to finish in a fair trade environment. The Citizenry donates 10% of proceeds directly back into artisan communities around the globe to help these entrepreneurs take their businesses to new heights. You guys, I have one of these lumbar pillows, and it's got this beautiful, colorful like design on it that's actually like very me, and it goes like, you know, it's like the lumbar pillow goes like almost all the way across the bed. It's super cool. I think it looks great. It's like just also nice to lean against. So yeah, like I love it. For a $50 gift voucher towards your first purchase of $200 or more, go to citizenrypodcast.com and enter fake. That's citizenrypodcast.com, CITIZENRY, podcast.com. The code is fake, and you'll get a $50 gift voucher toward your first purchase of $200 or more. Their stuff is totally beautiful, so go do it. Welcome back. Let's not waste any time, and let's move right into topic number two. For this next topic, I'm joined by John Lovett and Sarah Pappalardo. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hi.
And what I wanted to talk about was, sorry, let me see where I was. So you guys, I have long complained that I can't get fun Republicans on this show. It's very hard. Like, who are they? Where are they? Like, you know, why aren't there more of them? I have never understood why conservatives don't have the same pipeline of like comedians and TV shows and just funny cartoons. Like, they just don't. So my question is, why? Like, why is that? Let's just solve that today. So just at a very basic level, why aren't conservatives as funny as liberals?
I mean, I don't have like an overarching theory, but I definitely know of the ones I know in my family, I could tell a long, nuanced joke about like the state of society today, and I could mention a penis in it. And at the end, my aunt would be like, why'd you have to mention that? That wasn't nice. Like, there's just this focus on, like, what's happening and not what something is about that right. constantly is a refrain. And also, even with Reductress posts, we'll get a lot of conservative reply guys being like, this is fake. Like, saying that satire is fake, like they've just discovered that this isn't real news and are bragging about it instead of realizing it's satire. That's also kind of strange.
Sarah is the founder, co-founder of Reductress, a site that everyone should read because it's very funny. So you have like a particular experience with that like conservatives are just not getting that there's a joke happening.
Yeah. We did a post before the election that was like, if Trump wins, I'm moving to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And there were tons of conservative men were just like, this is fake. The author should be fired. Like a guy wrote a whole think piece about like what's wrong with the world based on this piece. And there just does seem to be like a lack of like understanding and any kind of irony. But
John, do you have any initial thoughts?
I do. I think one issue is I think there are conservative comedians, but they think and we treat them as if they're liberals. That one of the consequences of there not being a home for lack of a better term, cosmopolitan conservatives. Conservatives who believe in limited government, love Ayn Rand, but don't mind gay people.
The Ann Coulter conservative, if I can say that.
I don't even think I would include her because she's so toxic on immigration. Mm. I mean, to me, it's like there really isn't a big representation of this. I mean, I think you would – it's the kind of person that would say – it's like what Howard Schultz would say, right? I'm fiscally conservative and socially liberal, which has come to mean moderate but actually means in any other part of the world conservative. And so because there's no home for libertarian-minded right-ish people who are not so enamored of racial politics and racial grievance, people like I maybe would include like some of, you know, I think Bill Maher sometimes falls into this category. I think there's a lot of comedians. There's a lot of white guy comedians that take on PC culture. They might even consider themselves Democrats or liberals, but actually what they have are conservative politics and they don't have a home. And because they know gay people and because
identity,
and they smoke pot, and identity issues tend to animate us, especially those who are well off, more than economic ones. They consider themselves liberals and then just can't stand either party.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because like that is definitely the chunk of conservatism that understands irony. Like they understand like the construct of a joke, but I think that identity politics is exactly where their liberalism stops. And just like the general idea that like we have at Reductress that we never, you know, make the victim the butt of a joke. Like that's there. These people who are anti-identity politics or whatever don't seem to have that target in mind or even just that like principle in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think like Ricky Gervais, right? Mm-hmm. There's somebody who's, I think, a lot of his stand-up kind of goes both ways. Sometimes I think it's a set of jokes that would work in front of the Daily Show audience, that would work for the Reductress audience, and then there are ramblings about trans people comparing them to monkeys, and mm-hmm. you're like, I don't like this. This doesn't feel like it's part of my world. That's because it's conservative humor that works for people who think they're conservative or don't think they're conservative, but either way, it works for them.
Right.
The Psychology of Popular Media Culture published new research that kind of tries to explain why this happens. And they tie it to the need for cognition, which is a psychological term that explains the enjoyment of thinking or analyzing a problem. And basically, in this study, they showed that liberals have more of the need for cognition. They enjoy thinking through a problem, whereas conservatives don't necessarily have that. So if we're dealing with something that's multi-layered, like satire, liberals like to like think it through and get to the bottom of the of its meaning, whereas conservatives are like, why is this joke happening? And the same holds true for irony and exaggeration, that conservatives are like, why is this exaggeration happening? Like, they just don't enjoy that kind of joke at all. They don't see the necessity of it.
Yeah, I don't. This is a tough one because I still feel like we're kind of, this is a different way of saying like Republicans are dumb. And I know that.
Right. And it's very awkward. Yeah, this is like, apparently a legitimate study. I don't know. And it feels awkward to say because it also makes it feels like it feels a little bit like I'm saying like conservatives all have autism and they don't understand like feelings or whatever, which is not, I mean, you know, obviously I'm not saying these things, the study is saying them, but yeah. It felt weird to even read about it, didn't it?
I am very skeptical of anything. I'm very skeptical of this kind of study because it, like, there are things that are objective, like what's going on in your brain during a scan, and other things are quite subjective, like how you identify your politics. Like, I think of how the word evangelical has changed so dramatically, right? It originally described a set of people with a set of beliefs, but as politics absorbed the term, it came to become a token for a set of political values, which is why you can have evangelical support people like Donald Trump. So I find those kinds of conclusions around the
suspect.
I don't know the study, but it's just my instinct is to be suspicious of anything that makes that broad of conclusion around something as subjective and changeable and malleable as political self-identity.
Right, because even irony itself is so culturally specific and is just like way more appreciated in the States and in the UK and Australia than anywhere
cultural else component,
in the world. So to use that as like a global identifier of Western liberalism, like whatever that means, it's suspect.
Right, and the other thing that was like maybe, you know, not great about the study was that like they said it had people listening to jokes that were like that were delivered by like a guy sitting behind a desk, which kind of seemed like the Daily Show. And so I think for some respondents it was like, I don't like the Daily Show, and now this guy is sitting behind a desk and delivering jokes like the Daily Show. So there's a little so they could have been, you know, basically messing up their own study.
They're triggered. Yeah,
in that way. But I did find it interesting, you know, this attempt at explaining this divide. It still doesn't explain, you know, there's still the outstanding question of, like, why haven't they built their own pipeline of media? It just, unless it's happening and I have no idea, like, but it's not really happening.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, look, I think it's hard to say. I also think part of it is if you want to be a successful person in comedy right now, the people that are hiring, the places that are making things, like they are liberal. They just are. They're not even liberal. They are liberal in a very specific kind of way. Mm-hmm. Like there's a very homogenous quality to the voice of liberal politics generally right now. I think that's in part a result of feeling threatened. And I think you feel bristling of that from the right, which is why I think you see people like Howard Schultz deciding that they're going to do something, even though there's no appetite for it outside of like elite conference goers. And then you see a bristling in it from the left of people that support Bernie Sanders and are constantly mocking the kind of liberal comedy that has currency right now. So, you know, I don't know.
And it's funny because like I shared an article that was from 2017. So it was like probably right after the inauguration or something, this article in, I don't remember. It was like USA Today or something. And the article was just like, there's going to be, you know, a backlash from conservatives for all of this liberal comedy, you know, like there's only so much of the John Olivers and Samantha Bees that we can handle, and conservatives are going to start coming up with their own and just wait and see what happens. And if you're not playing to the vast, you know, red state population, you know, you're going to be sorry. And the interesting thing is now looking at that article that's 2 years old is that did not happen at all. Like nobody was trying. I mean, there's I think there's some narrative shows, like some sitcoms that might be like, we're on a farm or whatever, that's like somehow maybe fake addressing the Midwest. I don't know.
Like Tim Allen is a conservative. He has had successful sitcoms on the air for years. And some of this doesn't get lumped into that. I think you have somewhat, like you go look at Netflix's list of stand-up specials, and a few of those are going to be the kind of it's never going to be called conservative, but it's going to be something. It's going to be a
Larry,
guy,
the cable guy, or whatever,
or even like more subtle, or just of a guy standing in front of me, like, can you believe these kids today? Like that,
the kids today
is conservative. That is conservative. A lot of what Louis C.K. did was in some ways conservative. So I just think that because our politics are so toxic and because Republican politics specifically has gone so far off the rails, it's just hard to actually sort people into groups because nobody wants to be nobody who lives in cities and is part of comedy. Nobody wants to be called conservative, but they are. They don't like it. They don't even want to maybe admit it to themselves, but they're conservatives.
Well, and I think there's the other thing about maybe do we not tire of it as liberals, that there's so much material that's addressed to us as liberals.
I hope not. We both got a lot riding on this.
Oh, yeah. Hey, ride this wave.
Because I do wonder, like, have we reached a saturation point?
In a way, but no. I mean, there's always something new to be said. It's just, I think something about the platforms that we consume tend to make us repeat the same ideas over and over again, and it does get a little stagnant. But I think that the people who are doing really good work are still, there's still room for them to say something new, and they are. But yeah, I mean, there's still a little bit of like a liberal echo chamber in comedy that like you need to work twice as hard to get out of.
And I think one of the things that happens with conservatives is when they make fun of liberals, and like I've been on conservative radio shows before, and you know, and I try, because it's like my whole thing is like, put me, you know, let me perform in red states, like put me in front of conservative audiences. I enjoy it. I think it's interesting. And sometimes it's great. And then sometimes I get eaten alive, right? Mm. And my Twitter feed is relentlessly attacked. And I think one of the differences is, you know, sometimes I'll hear a thing that it might be funny, and I can't even give you an example of one. I'm trying to think, because there's not that many that are like just legitimately funny. But then most of it is really just telling me I'm a libtard or whatever, like just mean, like my physique or my voice or my whatever, like, you know, they're just attacks. They're mean. There's nothing funny about them. Like I would almost appreciate it if they were funny. And I think part of that is that liberals do a really great job of mocking themselves, you know? So for as much as we dish it out, we're also making fun of our, you know, gender-neutral bathrooms, and we're making fun of our, like, we're very self-critical constantly.
Right. We had Portlandia.
Exactly.
I don't imagine Jacob Wool will be making fun of himself anytime soon.
Right. And so I think that's part of it that makes, you know, because if there is a conservative out there that's funny, I would watch it. Mm. You know what I mean? I would consume that media.
I also think part of it, though, is it's easy to be critical of yourself in a safe space of a community of liberals laughing together. You know, I think that the fact that there is this giant apparatus, you know, we don't have a right wing propaganda machine, but the comedy machine is pretty good.
I
think we feel safe inside of it and quite powerful inside of it and comfortable enough inside of it to make fun of ourselves. I mean, I think Veep does that really well. Yeah. Like Veep often will come at you with a surprisingly conservative joke, and I think that's good. I think it shows a kind of it's why the show was so excellent and so surprising at times, because it was willing to go really hard in a lot of different directions. But the right has no equivalent of that. They just have their anger. I mean, part of this is like we just operate on different ways. You know, for the right, you know, they are animated by anger. They're animated by fear. I think that's the nature of their politics, and that's not even. I mean, that is. It's a vice of their politics, but if your politics is around, nationalism and closing the borders and kind of protecting what's yours and all of that that goes into that undergirds conservative politics, hate and fear are going to animate your base. On the left, we're different. Inspiration matters to us and humor matters to us. It's just that we're animated by different things. So I think maybe that's also just part of it.
Yeah, like it's like the Rachel Maddow versus the Rush Limbaugh. You know, it's like she's like a genteel person that likes to reflect but then still likes to get a little worked up, you know, whereas Rush is like yelling, you know?
I will say, I try to read Jonah Goldberg's newsletter. It's a conservative newsletter, and I try to read it every week, in part because it's something that is so clearly written by a conservative for conservatives. And it feels like a community newsletter of conservatives. And I think that it's not a coincidence that it's funny for conservatives inside of there. And I do think some of the funniest things I've ever read about Democrats I've read in that newsletter. Mm-hmm. And I obviously don't agree with his politics and I don't agree with the world he'd want to build, but I'm glad I read that every week and I do see what it's like, because maybe part of humor is feeling safe enough to be funny too.
There's such a
drive and a zeal to winning and power in their media that where's the jokes? But in a place where he's just sort of sitting back and saying, here's what I saw this week, it's a little bit more chill.
Some jokes
managed to find their way in.
Interesting. Okay, I've got to check that out. All right, you guys, let me know what you think on all of the social media platforms or yell at me on the street. That's the best one, is when you just see me on the street and just yell me your opinions. And now let's move on to our final topic. That is topic number 3. A new study found that 13 Reasons Why, which is a show on Netflix about a teenager who commits suicide, was associated with a 28.9% increase in suicide rates among teens. And to talk about this phenomenon and the larger issue of accountability, we have with us Dan Taberski. Hey, Dan.
Oh, my God.
And Aaron Jackson.
Hello.
I know, totally a dark subject.
Let's talk about
the fact that somebody would bring me in to talk about this is just terrifying.
Sorry.
That's going to make kids commit suicide.
Have you guys seen the show?
I have not. I haven't read the book or seen the show.
No, I mean, I know a little bit about it.
Yeah, same.
I saw the entire first season.
Did you like it?
I heard it's quite compelling.
Yeah, actually was into it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's interesting because as an adult, well, I don't have any suicidal ideation thoughts. So it's hard for me to like comprehend what it's like to sit in that skin and watch the show. From my perspective, it felt like, oh, this is a great starting point for why suicide is terrible, you know? But it's not, but that's not what happens, right? I was reminded by reading some of the articles on this, suicidal contagion has been around forever. Mm. Like in 1774, there was something called the Werther effect, which was a rash of suicides followed by the publication of Goethe's novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther.
Which is such a beautiful name for a book, isn't it?
The Sorrows of Young Werther.
But it then makes me think of the hard caramel candies, actually.
Which came out because of this book.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that this contagion effect is not anything new.
Yeah.
But the show was actually like very compelling,
right?
You know, for like YA media.
Totally.
Do you feel like, what do you think should happen in a situation like this? Who has a responsibility
it's
to do
tough.
What?
It's I do remember. I remember when there was backlash when the show came out. Before even it was like, oh, this is a suicide show. This is bad for teens. But I remember thinking, like, aren't there all, and I'm not trying to reduce it, but it's like suicide porn kind of things that, like, that stuff has been, it would, like, tug at the heartstrings. Like, that I feel like has been around. And then that article since, like, the 1770s and probably before then. So I don't know, but I do think it can be irresponsible. Like, Stephen King has a pen name he used to before he got discovered, and he would write darker books. And he wrote one about a school shooting in the 70s. And then he asked for it to be
removed
after Columbine, and it's not in print and hasn't been in print anymore. And granted, he's like a fucking multimillionaire, so
he can
skin
do
off
shit
his
like
back.
That. Yeah.
But still,
well,
like Netflix
is also
God, so like they don't need to make this show. So there are you do have some sort of responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a big deal if you're going to take that serious issue and know that, that teenagers can be influenced by that. I also can't, but I will say a couple things. The study doesn't. The study doesn't have anything to do. There was a rate of the rate of suicide increased at that time when the show premiered, but there's no proof that any of those kids actually watched that show.
That's
and there
true.
Was another study mm-hmm. showing that kids did watch that show who watched the whole second season actually had a lower rate of suicide. And so I do think it's irresponsible
right,
the
then,
way these headlines
but
are
but
being
if they,
written.
If they stopped in the middle before finishing season two, they had a higher risk of suicide. That same study showed.
I do think it's interesting that the show premiered in March of 2017. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah.
And that's the thing that they're pulling out about what's happening in the world that's going to make people commit suicide.
Yeah,
I will say, at the beginning of 2017.
What else happened at the beginning of 2017?
I don't recall that year.
Dude, no joke. How are you feeling in 2017?
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
true.
A lot of really intense things are happening in the world. And I do think it's a little irresponsible to pin it on this one show.
Sure.
I think it's an important conversation to have. I do think some people have been writing about it in a way that I think is irresponsible and that they're saying, like the New Yorker was writing, like, why they wrote in a caption, like, why did Netflix choose to ignore the concerns about doing a show like this when nobody says that they ignored it? They may have considered it quite well. They may have talked to experts.
Mm-hmm.
They may have really considered how to do a show like this. That in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, Catcher in the Rye, like teenagers, there's books that move teenagers and talking about things that are sensitive is not necessarily a bad thing if you do it in a responsible
right.
way.
Right, and it's, how weird would it be like to, we can't make art about suicide.
Yeah.
You know,
it's dynamic,
it's dramatic, it's fascinating, you know, like it's, so it is, and it could make a conversation. Isn't Dear Evan Hansen a suicide play too? And that won the Tony, right?
I have not seen it.
I haven't seen it either.
I haven't seen it either.
Maybe spoiler alert.
I know, or it's like about a guy in a stamp collection. Literally,
I'm pretty sure it's like a kid who, you know, it's like about him, and then at the end he goes, it's a suicide play.
So there are responsible ways to do this, and it sounds like that Netflix did do a lot of, like they aired a little special before the show aired and say if you're thinking about suicide.
And
like,
they have the disclaimer, which no one cares about, but like they
but it's
do
important to
say
it.
Like this is
right. They
sensitive.
Have the actor coming out and saying it, the one who in whose character commits suicide.
Right.
That's smart too.
Other studies suggested that news coverage of suicide plays a role in roughly 10% of suicides by people younger than 25. Either by giving these people like the idea to commit suicide or by giving them like ways of how to do
it.
Or like emotion, the resonance, like to seeing
like,
that out there just sort of might push somebody to do it, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. Like, can you recall your teenage years feeling more moved by shit like that? Like,
Oh, yeah,
so,
sad stuff. And
mine was, like, music more, because I would have been against, I was, like, very against things that were aimed, targeted at my age group.
Uh-huh,
I was like,
uh-huh.
you know, that's fucking, that sucks. But, like, sad, like, really sad, like, Elliot Smith style,
right.
who did kill himself, right? Like, that kind of music, woo.
Right.
Give it
and
to
then,
me, sad.
And then, so, like, the suicide of someone like that,
mm-hmm.
according to these studies, would have been very influential to
right.
the
Chris
suicide
Cornell
rate.
Committed suicide around the same time that their show premiered, right? So, I mean,
yeah,
is that...
Yeah, but it's funny, too, because when they mentioned that Chris Cornell thing, I was like, yeah, but he's not, like, a current...
Yeah, but I
Does
think people
matter?
Pick...
I guess
I don't
know.
People pick up things.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I don't know.
So what is it about?
I don't
about?
Even know who Chris Cornell is.
You pulled his name out.
Soundgarden.
I read the article.
Black Hole Sun, won't you come?
I'm going to commit suicide now.
You guys, but like when you're, I think, what's interesting is like when you're a teenager, I think the other, being you were saying like things media that was like geared towards your age group you thought was like dumb.
Yeah.
I also think disclaimers about media geared towards your agent. Like, there's something right. about the disclaimers that Netflix posted that felt a little like, who's listening to that? Oh, you know yeah. what I mean?
Or it makes you want it more. You're like, oh, this is bad. Right. You know, yeah, like, yeah, that's yeah, like exactly. the porn thing. Like, exactly. every, no fucking kid there's is like, I'm like, under 18. I'm, you yeah, know, like.
Yeah. Well, it's a little, because those disclaimers felt a little bit like, don't talk down to me, you motherfucker. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Although I will say, like, if it's the, if that sounds, I haven't seen it, but it does sound effective that if the whole show is based around this girl who committed suicide and then yeah. the girl comes out.
That's smart.
And you sort of process it in your head. She's not dead.
Yeah,
she's
yeah,
here
yeah.
and she's real and she's telling me not to do that. I think it may sound hokey, but I do think it's important to remind people who are feeling desperate. Like even if it reaches nobody but one person.
Right.
It's hokey, but like.
I think the other thing, I mean, and this is not something that the study necessarily addressed, but like, is just the online stuff, like being a teenager and living online.
Yeah.
You know, like the three of us probably didn't have
right.
Facebook no. or whatever, Instagram, Snapchat no. when we were in school. And so I wonder, like, you know, if that somehow exacerbates these rates. Just, yeah, I just wonder what effect that stuff
yeah.
is having.
I mean, social media, double-edged sword, like, if you're in a, if you feel ostracized, you can find a community online, right. but also you can be ostracized online. And so it's hard. Yes. It's hard to say. Like, yeah. I'm sure it has been wonderful for some teens who have found a community of like, oh, one day I'll get out of my horrible fucking town or whatever, yeah. this group of people and there's a bigger world out there. But I'm sure for some people it's like, shrunk them down and made them
Can
feel worse.
Can I just say about that, though? It's funny. Like, I think about my own high school and where the people who couldn't find a community anywhere joined the drama club.
Hello, me.
Right? Thank you, Nagin Farsad, vice president of the theater company. Thank you very much. President of the debate team.
Okay.
And,
a joiner.
And so I think the idea – I wonder, again, because I didn't grow up in this era,
yeah.
but I feel like being a member of the drama club is more satisfying than being, you know, in a subgroup.
Chat room or
yeah.
whatever. Chat room. Oh, God. That's not
a
real.
Chat
that's
room.
Not
yeah.
real.
Yeah, that's not even a thing they do anymore.
It's like
being in a chat room. Yeah.
Being in a typewriter.
Right.
but yeah, so I feel like I wish, and this is not something that, you know, 13 Reasons Why I talked about, but I do wish that there was maybe more of a like what to do, you know, where are you going to get your joy? You're going to mm-hmm. get it from human interaction. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, that was a callback.
Weird, no, it's okay. We're recording this during Ramadan, and one of my goals is human interaction.
Perfect.
But yeah, so like, where do you get your joy? And I think, you know, but you're right. Like, why, you know, what would, if we're going to say, like, what if Netflix, I think it would be make sense, though, if Netflix is like, okay, it's coming back for a third season, but it's not going to come, but that's it.
But she's not really dead. She comes back.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
She, like, pops out of a closet.
It was like, just kidding, that was bad.
Yeah. The whole time.
It was a dream.
Yeah. Well, what if there was a media that depicted really, really gory murders? Actual documentary video footage of like beheadings and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, there was. Anybody ever see Faces of Death? That was like a really big thing when I was growing up. It was like bootleg VHS copies of Faces of Death. It was just murders and dead people.
Just
and like,
at one after the other? Like, it was just a montage
ways.
Of murders?
Yeah, it was some of it was snuff from what I remember. Some of it was like just images of dead people that you wouldn't normally see. It was really upsetting.
That sounds horrifying. Now, yeah. what if Netflix
no, it's terrible.
Put that up?
That's irresponsible.
It's like that. What? Wasn't that senator that was, is it a senator? It was like when they were talking about pornography. And
I don't know what it is.
I know it when I see it.
Yeah,
it's like
that
where it's like, what is art versus what is like, oh, you can't do that. That's not art. It's like, I know it when I see it. It's like, I don't know what.
Well, because it's interesting. Like, you know, we've talked about this on the show before of like Facebook moderators having to look at a bunch of like murders and then determine, oh, this is not appropriate for Facebook or whatever.
Yeah. And then those people all.
So there's so, by the way, so much murder that the moderators have to watch.
I know.
Like every day. I also am just shocked by how much murder gets filmed.
Yeah.
Like literal murder. I mean, you know,
wow.
I've never been around a murder. Hopefully I will never be around a murder.
Right.
What would I, you know, but I don't know that my instinct would be to take out a camera. Anyway, I just think it's like really, the whole thing is just shocking.
So you're coming down, anti on murder.
I'm against.
Hot take.
Against. So you're basically, but if Netflix were to actually say no more of this show, we're pulling the show, would you find that reasonable or would you be worried about the slippery slope?
I would applaud any decision. If they made their own decision to pull something based on evidence that scholars were presenting to them, I think that would be really responsible. But I also think that it's important that they consider what they're doing and move forward based on the merit of the work. And even though they're making money off it, it's somebody's art. It's somebody's vision. And if they think there's still something to tell and they're doing it responsibly, why not?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think you have to be careful when you're making like monetized art about a sensitive subject. But I mean, this country is certainly never careful about like violence depicted in films. Like we don't give a fuck. And we have a crazy an insane gun culture, you know? Yeah. So it's like, but no one is talking about like, maybe we shouldn't have people just heroes just killing 100 people in a movie, you know, but like,
I mean, the interesting thing is like, a Star is Born ends with a suicide, right? Like
totally.
Nobody talks about
spoiler.
That.
Spoiler.
Oh my God, Dan, Jesus.
Well,
it's already happened.
It happened a long time. It lost
now.
The damn Oscar. It lost.
Yes, it does end in a suicide.
And that's, I mean,
nobody
kids who are watching that show
that.
Are watching Gaga.
And that was a very popular movie.
And I thought that suicide, that felt like really unearned and fucking out of nowhere. Whereas in
really
to me, well,
oh
I thought
God.
The whole movie.
Did we watch
I have notes
movies?
On the movie. but
let
I haven't
get
watched
Bradley
13.
Cooper on the phone. You can just tell him directly.
I could see that take. I could see that point of view.
It was like okay.
No,
here we go. Act three. You know.
what was unearned is like them was Gaga smashing the art afterwards because she was so
God,
angry.
I know
that was
poor
unearned.
Poor Gaga. She earned her Oscar though for that
did.
Song.
She
great
really
tune.
She's adorable.
Okay, so I get but that's a really good point about that ending in a suicide, and yet we're not like looking at studies about how that affected people.
Yeah. And
although,
again, it's
maybe
not,
we will.
It's not causation. It's association, not causation. The study is. You know, and there's a point where they put studies out to attach to popular culture because they want to get attention for their work, too. And there's an irresponsibility to that
totally.
I find suspect.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, you guys.
We solved it.
I'm like on the fence. I mean, I can see see pulling it. I can see keeping it. I can see all these arguments. And I don't know. Maybe I would want more something baked into the actual show that would also influence teens in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and whatever that is, I don't know. The experts know. I don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. But, baked into the narrative. Not like the actor comes and does a PSA, you know, because that feels a little flimsy. Mm. All right, you guys. Did you watch 13 Reasons Why? What do you think? Would you let your kids watch it? Would you let your kids watch it, by the way?
I wouldn't have kids.
And I don't know. I don't know. I haven't seen it. Maybe I'd watch it first, but oh God.
Kids are gonna kids need to read and see and feel things that move them.
Okay.
That's like you said, it's Elliott Smith, it's music.
Yeah.
It's like that's what kids are doing. They're just like busting with all this
emotion. Adult emotion that they can't control and suppress yet.
Yeah, they're built for that. Right, totally. You'll learn.
You'll learn. Bottle it.
Yeah.
All right.
right. You guys, that's the end of the show. I wanted to thank you for listening. And I also wanted to thank you to the production team at Fake the Nation. That's our producer, Harry Nelson, our audio engineer, Jared O'Connell. Gabby Alter wrote our theme music. Lily Fleshler helps with research. And you guys, you know I love hearing from you. I love hearing your voice faces. The face, the voice that comes out of your mouth hole. And I love it when that mouth hole is giving me topics that you want to hear us talking about, guest ideas, I don't know, recipes. You can leave us a voicemail at 347-770-4981, or you can drop us a comment at comments@fakethenation.com. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts because it helps people find the show. You guys, that's the end of it. I'll talk to you next time.